His name is Jeff, and he is from San Diego. I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker, Jeff from San Diego. Jeff from San Diego. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Thank you, John, for asking me to come speak tonight. Thank you to everybody who puts on this meeting. Thanks, Mike, R, wherever you are, for all you do here, man. It's good to know you and walk this path with you. He's in the back over there. And thank all of you for being here. You know, it's an honor. Legitimately feels like an honor to me to be here right now. Also, I'd like to congratulate the token takers, Keith for 90, Jose for 90, Abram for 1 year. Nice work, man. That's a big deal. And Stephen for 11 years. Congratulations. Also, welcome to the newcomers. Welcome to everyone who's new, anybody who's feeling new, you know? Juan, Tony, Nicole, I'm glad you're here, you know? My sobriety date is July 5th of 2020. So I just celebrated 5 years a week ago. And we've got a little bit of time, so I'm thinking I'll tell you guys about my background, maybe tell you about my kind of journey, especially with drinking and drugs, because there was both involved, and then how I came to AA and how I came to go from the guy I was to standing here before you with 5 years sober and a pretty good life. You know, I was born in Northern California, in Palo Alto, in 1984. So I'm 40 years old, just turned 40 in December. And by all accounts, like, family I was born into, the situation I was born into was, like, pretty good. You know, my dad was, like, a working professional in technology. He was, like, a tech guy. My mom, like, very loving, kind mother. I had two older brothers. And we lived in the Bay Area, you know, while I was a kid. Pretty normal, like, pretty good. Good childhood. And, you know, I didn't really know what was going on at the time, but like we started moving around a lot. So then we moved to Evergreen, Colorado, and I lived up in the mountains, and I was just a kid, so I kind of just went where I was taken. And so I, you know, went from playing in the cul-de-sac to like playing in the woods. And, you know, by all accounts, like I thought things were still like pretty good. And, you know, then we moved again. We moved to Texas. I didn't know why we were moving to Texas. I didn't want to move. I just knew that, like, I had to go, and I had to say goodbye to all my friends, and I was, you know, frustrating and sad. So this is, like, my third move. We go to Houston, Texas. And, you know, about this time, say I'm 8 years old, 7, 8 years old, I remember starting to, like, I couldn't really tell what was going on, but I could start to, like, sense, like, something wasn't quite right in our house. You know, I didn't really know what it was, but, like, I started to feel a little more, like, tension. And my parents would have dinner parties, and they were doing the, like, big Texan thing. And I remember when I was even, like, 7 or 8 years old, I don't know if this has anything to do with my alcoholism or not, but I used to go around to the dinner table that they would leave little remnants of, like, wine in their wine glasses. And as a little kid, I remember just, like, sneaking around. And I wanted to, like, taste it. I wanted to, like, taste the wine. It was red wine. I could remember. It would just be, like, a very tiny amount. I drank it. I didn't feel any effect from drinking it, but I just remember doing that. You know, thinking back to, like, the first time I ever tasted alcohol, that was it. And I don't know why I did it. I think I, like, there was something about the being mischievous that, like, I liked. You know, like, it was exciting. You know, I didn't have a whole lot of control as a kid, and, like, I was feeling some frustration. And, like, that was something I could do. I just remember that feeling, you know? And, So I remember that was like my first, you know, alcohol. I would go around the table doing that. And then, you know, by the time I was like 8 or 9, you know, things started to get a little bit more like explicit in my house. You know, I remember being in Texas, like doors were closed and now I could hear like some yelling going on. And it was like my parents arguing. And I didn't know what they were arguing about. I just know the door was closed and there was a lot of loud voices and I felt scared. And then later, my dad would come out and say, like, you know, are you okay? Like, how's it going? And I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. Like, what's going on? He's like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, okay. Like, I don't know how to not worry about it, but okay. And it's like, okay, I got to just go to my room now. And this type of thing started to progress, you know? So, like, I mean this to say, like, by all accounts, my upbringing, my life, my circumstances growing up, like, overall were, like, very good. I have, like, a loving father, I had a very loving mother, two older brothers. Like, I had to have a lot of really good experiences in my childhood. And for the most part, pretty stable. Except that what was actually going on was my mom was alcoholic. And I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I didn't understand at the time that that's what it was. But she was alcoholic. And from the time I was 8 until the time I was 29, I watched her slowly and precipitously drink herself to death. And when I was 29, she fell off a ladder and hit her head. And her brain bled and she died. And that's kind of how it ended. At the time, though, I didn't really understand what was going on. You know, I just felt uncomfortable and scared. And I remember my reaction to that was anger. Like, I have always been a very emotional and a very intense person. Like, I don't get quiet. I don't get shy. I don't, like, run from things. I get very combative. I always have. And I remember when I was, like, 8 or 9 in this house in Texas, like, I lived there with my brothers and my dad and my mom. I started seeing actual signs. Like, I would find my mother, like, passed out in the closet. I would see vodka bottles, like, strewn about the kitchen. And now I understood what the problem was, right? Like, I didn't understand, like, the full implications of what it was, but I could tell that, like, this was something that my mother was doing, and it was the source of this friction, and it had to stop, and I needed to let her know. And I didn't know what was going on, but I was just super combative with her from that point on. Like, from the time I was 8 or 9 in Texas, like, why would you do this? Why would you do this to our family? Like, how could you do this when you're gonna, like, destroy everything we have? Like, I couldn't wrap my head around it. I have since come to develop much, much more empathy and compassion for what my mother was going through. But I didn't understand it actually until I got sober and made amends to her in my 9th step, which I'll tell you about here in a bit. The reason I mention this is because, like, this, I want to give you some background. This was kind of like the way I grew up and, like, how I was exposed to alcohol and alcoholism and what my family dynamic was like. We moved a couple more times. We moved from Evergreen to Texas to California. I didn't understand at the time, but my mom was doing geographics. She thought she'd be happier somewhere else. My dad was trying to keep the family together. And so we kept moving around and I kept making new friends and I didn't like it, but I didn't have a choice. And, you know, then when I was about 13 years old, I was living in Denver, Colorado, and I had two older brothers, 5 and 6 years older than I was. So I'm 13, they're like 18 and 19, right? Something along those lines. Maybe I was 12. And, you know, they started having access to actual alcohol. So, like, I remember my brother having a handle of something, like, up in his closet. And when I could, my little friends and I would, like, sneak down, like, hey, can we get, like, a little bit of that? And he would give it to us. And, again, like, it was partially, I think, the mischievousness of it. Like, we were doing something sneaky, and that felt good because I didn't have a lot of ways to exercise my, I don't know, assert my authority or control or something, you know, like this, like I had all this energy and this frustration inside of me and I wanted to go somewhere. And so, like, I could do that. And when it was sneaky, it kind of felt good. There was something about that I've always liked and to this day kind of like. And so that's when I really had, I think, like my first, like, real drink. I remember drinking in the basement of our house in Colorado. And I just liked it. It wasn't like a white light moment. It wasn't like any magical thing where I had a drink and suddenly all this, like, pain was, like, alleviated. I just liked it. It was fun. It was exciting. And that's kind of like how the journey started for me. I drank in my basement with my brother and some of our friends. And over the course of the next number of years, from the time I was, I don't know, like 10 to like time I was 15, I just, like, little by little started pursuing it more and more because I associated excitement and fun as being the goals. That's what I wanted out of life. I thought the goal of life was to have more excitement and, like, higher experiences and, like, do something more amazing. And I just kind of always naturally associated alcohol and then later drugs with that. So it was fun. You know, I was a teenager. I thought I was having fun. You know, in the background, like, my mom's going off the rails and my dad is like a working businessman, so he's traveling. So I was kind of like on my own, not necessarily in a bad way, but like I had a lot of like autonomy, like probably more than was good for me. So we had like this basement, we could come and go. I got older brothers, I got access to alcohol. So I'm drinking with my buddies and we're having a good time. And I just remember it being fun. I don't remember it being this big emotional thing. I don't remember like any huge trauma associated with it. I was just kind of like over the dynamic with my parents, and I had the autonomy to do my own thing, so I did. And I was having a good time. And this went on like through high school, basically. You know, we came out to California when I was, 14, I guess. At this point, like, my parents divorced, because it turns out my dad was trying to like keep the family together well beyond the point that his marriage was tenable. And so he stayed with my mom because, like, in Texas at the time, a judge told him, like, look, if you get divorced, like, she's getting the kids. That's just how it works in Texas. And he said, well, that's not an option. So he stayed in the marriage. But by the time I was 13, my mom was, like, off the rails, crashing cars, having affairs. Like, it wasn't good. And so they got divorced, and I went off with my dad to California because my two brothers were off in college and, you know, they got divorced, and my dad told my mom, you know, you can take anything you want in the house, and she took everything. And we're literally sitting on a mattress in the living room of this house in Colorado. We'd gone to like the flea market to try to get some art, so it was like cheap used art. We're sitting like, he's depressed, I'm like, what's going on here? We're sitting on this mattress in the living room looking at this flea market art on the walls, and he's just like, this is not good. And I was like, you're right, this is not good. And I remember my dad asking me, like, you know, what should we do? And I said, like, well, we should get out of here. And he goes, well, where should we go? And I said, California? Like, I don't know why I said California, but he was like, okay, like, great, I like California. One thing I forgot to mention about this period of time, so I know how old I was now. I'm 13, I was in the eighth grade. I got expelled from the eighth grade for selling weed. I had the bright idea that I was going to, like, buy a small amount of weed and sell it for... Yeah, you guys get the idea. And sell it for something that it as something that it wasn't for more money, and then I was going to accumulate all this money, and then I'd have more autonomy to do what I wanted to do. It didn't work out. My strategy was to like call people in the middle school directory, and I got immediately busted, and they like kicked me out of school. So I'm expelled. We're sitting on this mattress. My dad says, like, let's get out of here. I say, great. We go to California. And I kind of just kept doing the same thing, man. Like, I was in Southern California, which was great. Like, I was like over the moon to come out to Southern California. It's beautiful. Like, I love it out here. I've basically been out here ever since. And coming from Denver, I was like, you know, beaches and like sunshine, like what's not to like. And still I had like a lot of autonomy, you know, and I kept like drinking more and more, you know, more and more. Like, I never did anything moderately. And I always kind of drank the same way, which is just like a lot. I always wanted more. I always wanted more. I never really like said like, oh, I'm good. I don't remember having the feeling like, yeah, I'm kind of good on like drinks. I literally don't remember ever once doing that. I just kind of like would go until like I shut down, which increased the time span over time. Cause you know, at the end it was like a couple days at a time. So this progression, right? Like if you're new, I don't know, like if this was your path too, but like for me, like drinking wasn't always problematic with all these horrible consequences, right? In the early days, it was fun, right? And then I started to experience some problems, so it was fun with problems. And then over time, like the cost and the benefit started to flip. I started to get more consequences with less benefit. And like, I didn't know how to get out. Like Abram was saying, like, there was just no way out. Like, I felt like I can't stop and I can't continue. Like, I'm just stuck. And, so through high school, like, I keep drinking more. I ended up going to college in Santa Barbara. That's when I got introduced to cocaine, right? That just, like, basically enabled me to go longer and harder. That's the only thing it did. And I moved to San Francisco, right, after college. Like, just continued drinking. I was, like, a terrible student in college. I was just drinking all the time. Because I don't know if any of you guys have ever been up to Santa Barbara, but there's a little community adjacent to the school, and it's just like somebody needs to just drop napalm over this entire like 12 by 12 blocks, because it is just I'm joking, but it's just like chaos, it's mayhem, it's like a bunch of college kids just partying and getting wasted, and it's debauchery. It's like if you could take like Mardi Gras and make it like 365 days a year, like that's what the Celtic community is like. And so I just kept drinking and doing drugs and like, you know, I'll fast forward a little bit because I don't want to go into like a huge like drunkalogue. But the point is like, I have learned, like many of you have taught me, that alcoholism is a progressive disease. And I was progressing along with this disease, or it was progressing me, and I didn't know it. So I end up in San Francisco. Let's fast forward to like, I'm like 27, 29 years old. And now like, I still have a job. I'm doing okay, but like, I'm pretty lonely now. I don't have a lot of friends anymore. I'm drinking a lot. When I drink now, it's like 2 days at a time, and I'm torching like all the money I have. I like drink 2 days in a row, and I'd go sit on this little strip of grass called the Panhandle. I don't know if any of you guys have been to San Francisco, but there's a big park called Golden Gate Park. And on the end of this park, there's a strip of grass they call the Panhandle because it looks like the handle of a pan. And I used to take my acoustic guitar like Monday morning after being on like a two-day bender and go with a like a bottle or whatever I had and go sit in the park and play my guitar and watch all these people drive like up and down the road alongside of the park, thinking to myself, like, what a bunch of losers. Like, these chumps are getting up and going to work. Like, I don't do that. I don't have to do that. Like, what? And I was, like, dead serious, right? Dead serious. And, like, obviously, like, I was the chump, and I didn't know it. I was the last person to know it. And ultimately, like, how I came to AA was I was dating a woman at the time who started to see this. She started to see how I drank, which was, like, a lot and aggressively and, like, wasn't good. You know, she didn't realize at first, but pretty quickly she realized what was going on. And she kind of gave me an ultimatum and said, you know, if you don't do something about this, like, something systematic, like, I'm out of here. And I had seen my mom at this point for 15 years, like, progressing along with her alcoholism. And I had enough self-awareness to realize, like, okay, like, if this is true, if somebody that I care about is giving me this ultimatum, like, they don't even want to be part of my life anymore unless I address this, like, they're probably right, you know? Like, I don't want to admit it, but, like, they're probably right. That's not when I got sober, right? My path to sobriety was not a white light experience. It was multiple and incremental steps of, like, trying, like I think it was being told about Abram, like, I bet you were sincere when you said, like, I'm done. I was sincere when I said I was done. But the problem is, like, what I said in that moment when I was done, I want to stop, there's another guy 10 days later who, like, has a different idea, you know? Like, he doesn't care about Jeff on day one. He's got his own ideas, right? And so I did this, like, over the course of, incrementally, I'd say I went to AA. My first meeting in AA was in off of Polk Street in San Francisco. And I remember this vividly. I didn't want to go to this meeting. I didn't want to identify, like, as an alcoholic because, like, my mom was alcoholic, or I had this idea in my head of what alcoholics were. And I didn't want to be that. I didn't really know what it was, but I had an idea in my head that it was like a bad, sad, weak person, and that wasn't going to be me. But I also had this like person in my life I didn't want to lose, and she's giving me an ultimatum. So I said, like, all right, fine, I'll go to kind of like get the heat off. And I go to this meeting. It's at the bottom of this church off of Polk Street in San Francisco, and I remember walking in, and it was exactly what I feared. There was like homeless people everywhere. The lighting was terrible, it smelled, like, I sat in the middle. I remember the speaker spoke, and there was this woman, and she shared her story, and I actually remember feeling like, I kind of relate to that, because she talked about just, like, drinking and trying not to drink, and then, but, like, doing it anyways in this, like, cycle where she, like, tried to stop and just couldn't stop, and then was sincere and, like, was having consequences and tried to stop and couldn't. And I was like, that's kind of like what I've been going through. And then I remember they said, like, yeah, if you're new, you want to come up and get a chip and a hug. And I did, and I was like, so anxious. And I remember I went up and I took the chip and a hug and I sat down. And as soon as the meeting was over, I was like, I was gone. Like, I was the first one out the door. Interestingly, 18 months later, somebody brought me back to that meeting. Same meeting, same day. I walked in, nice lighting, a lot of like working professionals, chandelier, a couple couches, same meeting. The only thing that had changed was my perspective, right? Exact same meeting. Like, it was like shocking how different it looked after 18 months. So that taught me something about perspective. So anyways, I guess the point I'm trying to make is, like, I don't know if all that stuff matters. Like, my past, my upbringing, stuff with my mom, the why of it, you know, like, my story, why I drink, why I do what I do. I'm not sure that it matters. What I've come to learn is, like, what matters for me when it comes to alcoholism and recovery is, like, the what of it and the how of it, right? Because I used to spend a lot of time thinking about, like, why I drank, why the situation was like this, why I don't want to go to AA, why. Like, I'm just going to think my way through all this stuff because I think I'm so smart, and if I can just figure it out, then I'll be good. It turns out, like, for me, the why question is not particularly helpful. It's just a lot of, like, intellectual spinning my wheels. And when I stopped asking, like, why, and I started asking questions like, what is going on? Like, what am I doing? What are the consequences of my behaviors? Like, what are my options? And if I conclude, like, well, what I'm doing is, like, drinking and using drugs way more than I want to, and what I'm doing is trying to stop and I can't stop, and what I'm experiencing is consequences that are unacceptable to me, like getting fired from jobs, having people say they're going to shut down relationships and leave me alone, feeling self-pity and anger and frustration and resentment and fear and shame, just more and more. If that's the what of it, then the real question that mattered for me at some point was, like, how can I change that, right? And as I mentioned, like, it took me, like, several iterations. I was in San Francisco. I did not want to go to AA. So I went to that meeting, and then I said, you know what? That's probably not the right path for me. I'll go to LifeRing. I'll go to Refuge Recovery. I'll go to, what was the one? Smart Recovery in the hospital. I'll go to therapy. I had the idea I was going to go see a psychiatrist, and I could get him to give me benzodiazepines because that would reduce my anxiety, and then I would be good. Of course, the doctor was like, there's absolutely no chance I'm going to give you benzodiazepines. Those are, like, basically, like, powdered alcohol. Like, he's like, you need to go to AA. I was like, yeah, not that. What else you got? So, and I just kept doing this, man. It was very hard for me to come, to become willing to come to AA. And I want to read something out of the 12 and 12, out of step 7, which I think really describes, like, kind of what it comes down for me. Because, like, what it really was a lot of ego, right? It was me thinking, like, I got this. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to rely on myself. I. So in step 7, which is all about humility, on page 74 it says, this improved perception of humility starts another revolutionary change in our outlook. Our eyes begin to open to the immense values which have come straight out of painful ego puncturing. Painful ego puncturing. Until now, our lives have been largely devoted to running from pain and problems. We fled from them as from a plague. We never wanted to deal with the fact of suffering. Escape via the bottle was always our solution. Character building through suffering might be all right for saints, but it certainly didn't appeal to us. Then, in AA, we looked and listened. Everywhere, we saw failure and misery transformed by humility into priceless assets. We heard story after story of how humility had brought strength out of weakness. In every case, pain had been the price of admission into a new life. But this admission price had purchased more than we expected. It brought a measure of humility, which we soon discovered to be a healer of pain. We began to fear pain less and desire humility more than ever. And the reason I wanted to read that is because, like, everything I was just saying, the whole point of it is to, like, illustrate that up until this point in my life, till I was 29, every single thing I did was just driven by a self-will. It was like me on my own. And I didn't need your help. I didn't ask for it. Didn't ask for your advice. I might smile politely and thank you, but, like, on the inside, I was like, I got this. And, man, it was just, like, a really, 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 really hard road. I made it way harder on myself than it had to be. And each time I went to one of these programs or I tried one of these new paths and it didn't work, and I found myself, like, on a plane to Las Vegas, like torching the rest of my money, like waking up in a casino, like full of shame and regret. And like, how did I get here again? You know, how did I get here again when 10 days ago I was absolutely resolute that I was done drinking. I wasn't going to drink anymore. And I would never do that again, no matter what. How could that be possible? Like in so many other areas of my life, I was able to use my willpower to accomplish things. Like I was working in San Francisco in tech sales, and I was good. I could just like work harder, dig in harder, like make more calls, do more, push more, and get results. But then when it came to like trying to modify my behavior around the way that I drank and used drugs, it was like it wasn't working. It was like this one area of my life that where that approach was not working. So I went through just countless beatdowns, like beatdown after beatdown, like trying to like do everything myself, and it just wasn't working. And the turning point for me was one day I was at this meeting called the Waterfront Meeting in San Francisco, and I was like, I didn't want to be there again. I had like 3 days sober, and I raised my hand, and they called on me to share, and I shared like, yeah, you know, I'm Jeff. Like, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic, but like, it's certainly not going well, and I don't know, like, I don't know what to do, like, and that was kind of it, really. And this guy behind me is like shook my hand, talked to me after the meeting, and it turns out he played tennis. I played tennis, and he's like, "Let's go play tennis sometime." And I was like, "Oh." So like, I didn't understand what was happening in that moment, but in that moment, like, the fellowship was like bringing me in. And it pulled me out of this, like, me on my own. And it brought me into the fold with you guys. And that was my first exposure to a power greater than myself. Because for 29 years, 30 years at that point, I had just been like running on self-will. And like in some areas I was doing okay, and like on paper maybe I was doing okay, but behind the scenes I was like dying inside. And I was like on my way to death for sure. But like in that moment, somebody reached out and shook my hand and like just was like, "Let's go play tennis and hang out." And that guy ended up being my first sponsor. And I got sober for a couple of months, and I was like, you know what, maybe like going to some different meetings and like playing sports with some people, like maybe there's something about this that I could get behind. You know, maybe it's not this like death sentence that I've told myself it was. And I became like a little bit open-minded. So when they talk about in the literature, like about in step three about willingness, like all we need is like to crack that door just a little bit, like that was a crack for me. And I like took a look inside. And from that point, I started getting like bigger and bigger chunks of sobriety. I like kept going to meetings. I didn't have like I wasn't like working the steps really. I wasn't really working the steps yet, but I kept going to meetings, and I stuck around, you know. And I listened, and I like got plugged in with you guys, and I stayed in the fellowship. And I got 3 months, and then I got 7 months, and then I got 2.5 years, and now I've got 5 years. And thank you. And so, like, if there's anybody out there who's, like, struggling or hears these stories of, like, it's, a white light experience, like, that was not my path. Like, it took several iterations. It took a lot of grit. It took, multiple surrenders and a lot of pain. But my experience has been, like, when I stay close and if I can be somewhat patient, I'm still in the game. You know, I'm still in the game and I still have a chance. Like, I'm not out unless I leave. And then I'm out. Even if I drink and use drugs or relapse, I'm still in the game if I come back. They say keep coming back. Like, that's my understanding of why. So anyways, I'm it's not clicking for me, right? Like, I'm like starting to get little chunks of time sober. Let's say I've got like a few months sober. I moved from San Francisco down to Los Angeles. And I have like an epic, epic bender. Like, I remember a combination of doing a lot of drinking, taking a bunch of Xanax, and then getting a phone call from somebody about playing a poker game in Santa Monica. Next thing I know, I had like drained all the cash out of my bank account. I was in a shitty casino in like Commerce, California. I was on the floor of the hotel room. I wasn't even on the bed. I'm lying on the floor the next day, crying, calling people to like come rescue me. And they took me to this like really awful detox center in Santa Monica where I got this 12 and 12, which I badly need to get recovered. And that's when things started to click, because near that meeting was a men's meeting that I started going to every day. It was 365 days a year. So it was a men's meeting at noon in the back of this Italian restaurant in Los Angeles, in Venice, California, where I was living at the time. Later it ran in Santa Monica. It was originally called Mario's and then Bravo and then Trastevere. It changed names, but it was not even a real AA meeting, actually. It was more like a men's luncheon, but it was an AA meeting for all intents and purposes. And I went there and I was beat up and I was like, I started listening to these guys, and these guys started talking about 1 minute on the problem, 2 minutes on the solution. And I was like, there was something really attractive about that to me, because it changed the story in my head from oh, this is a bunch of losers who aren't I don't want to be to wow, I actually kind of admire these guys. They're talking about they drank and used drugs the way that I did, but they don't anymore. And when they talk about a problem, they'd say you know what, I'm frustrated and angry at my wife because she did this and that, but here's what I did, and here's how I'm going to make it right, or here's how I did make it right. And I was like, okay, so these guys are owning their shit and kind of on top of things and seem like they're doing well. And so I asked this guy to sponsor me at that meeting. His name was Rob V. It was painful for me to be sponsored by this guy for 7 years. But he taught me a lot, man. This guy sat down with me. We read the big book and the 12 and 12 cover to cover. He gave me this worksheet to start doing step one, asked me a bunch of questions about my history. And I don't know, man, we would just I would go to two meetings a day. And the first thing he did was he helped me develop a routine. So for anybody who's new here, I'll say this. For me, the 12 steps in the literature, super important, but it wasn't the first thing that I needed. The first thing that I needed was to get plugged in with people I could relate to and start to develop a routine. And the routine that I needed to involve morning prayer, but the first thing I do is get out of myself into something else. Even if it's little, I don't got this. And I would say the third step prayer, the serenity prayer. I didn't really understand what I was doing, but what I was doing was developing a little bit of humility, shifting my mind from I got this today to maybe I'll take my hands off the wheel, right? Maybe just a little bit. And then I would go to meetings and I would make phone calls. And I would I got started reading the book with my sponsor after I could see straight after 30 days. And we started working the steps, man. And we would sit in the back of this alley in Santa Monica where these meetings were. And we would sit. He would give me we would read. He would give me like writing to do in the fourth step. I would come back. He would say okay, but did you consider this? And I would say no, let me try again. And we, the combination of developing a routine and working the steps with a sponsor ended up being the thing that freed me from this 3 decades of self-reliance that was making me so uncomfortable that I felt like I needed to pump my body full of alcohol and drugs all the time. And the first step was just crashing and burning 100 times, The second step was that little window where I could see maybe there's something bigger than me that can help me here. First it was someone reaching out their hand in AA, and then it was this fellowship I found in Santa Monica, and then it was a sponsor who was willing to I didn't understand why, sit and read with me once a week and talk to me on the phone every day and listen to all my nonsense and help me for no particular reason. And as we started reading the books and working the steps, I started to see oh man, all the stuff in the book, I relate to it. This self-will, I love more about alcoholism, the chapter in the big book, because it just pounds the point home. And if we were not thoroughly clear about this, about the problem here, it is self-will, self-centered thinking. You think you got this. You do not got this, right? And it's and I'm just I needed to hear it that 10th time to be okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's me. And then, man, when we did the fourth step, I wrote down all the most shameful things I had done, everything I could think of that I was scared of, all of my resentments toward people, everything I felt guilty about. And I even had a category at the end of miscellaneous. I didn't even know where to put some of this stuff. But my sponsor told me, write it down. Get it out. The point is to get it out and get accurate about it. And then we'll figure out what to do with it once it's on paper. So we start working steps, and we do a fourth step, and I sat outside with my sponsor. I told him everything. And I remember he asked me, like, is that it? Like, did you leave anything out? And I remember the answer was like, no, absolutely not. Like, I knew for sure I didn't leave anything out because I was like so petrified to tell him everything. And he just looks at me and he smirks and he goes, oh, if it makes you feel any better, I've heard worse. And I was like, yeah, it kind of does actually make me feel a little better, to be honest. So, you know, we're in LA and now it's like, I got like 6 months sober at this time. I've like written a four step, like totally honestly. I've done a fifth step. We start getting into six and seven and the steps. And like, I kind of like could get what they meant, but I don't think I really fully understood the implications of steps six and seven, which really have to do a lot with like character building. So we kind of like touched on them and looked at them, but I didn't really like go deep into them right away. And then step seven, the humility part, at this point, like it really made a lot of sense to me. Because at this point, I had spent enough, I was like, my mind was clear enough and I had enough time in AA and sober with you guys that I could look back and see this like wreckage in my past that was all caused by my self-will. Like it was obvious. Like it was kind of like disgusting to me actually. I was like 3 decades of just like chaos. And so the idea that like humility, you know, it talks about in the literature that like humility is kind of like the principle behind each step and like really like the key for me to my liberation from each of these problems, which are all happening in my mind, really Jeff thinking about Jeff. Humility kind of is the antidote to that. Made a lot of sense to me. So I was like, okay, I'm on board with step seven, right? Okay, I'm starting to like, this is starting to click here. The steps, like how the steps make sense, like it's like starting to come together. We get to step eight and I was like, oh, no. Like, oh, I don't wanna do this. Like, he's like, all you gotta do is make a list. So I'm like, oh, this is gonna be a long fucking list. And so I make the list and we just start knocking them out, you know, one by one, starting with some easy ones, working through like me addressing the worst things I've done in my life, straightforwardly, you know, not apologies, not half-winded things, just brass tacks. Like I just went to everybody I had harmed, as is outlined in the book, like, here's why I'm here. I'm in a 12-step recovery program. I'm here to like address the ways that I believe I have harmed you. If you're willing, I'd love to like have a conversation with you about that and try to make it right however I can by you. And they were like, some people were like, oh, that's weird. Some people were like, okay. And I would say my piece and we would go through it. And it didn't matter. The point is it didn't matter what the outcome was. Some people were super cool about it. Some people were in between. And there's some people were not super happy to see me. But that's not the point. The point was like, I cleaned up my side of the street 100%, just like I did in my four step. So when I was done making my amends, I didn't have any more like open loops in the back of my mind nagging at me, making me uncomfortable, making me feel like, oh, you know, I got some secret, something unaddressed. Like I knew it was all addressed. There was like nothing I hadn't looked at, nothing I hadn't dealt with. And then basically like step 10 was like, okay, well, what you just did in steps 4 through 9, where like you get accurate by writing inventory about all of your resentments, all of like, you know, how it affects you, like the stories you're telling yourself, like what your role in that actually is, all of your fears, right? What's behind those fears? How fear is like just a real lack of faith, really is what I learned. All the things I feel guilty and shameful about, including like harms done to others and sexual misconduct, like all of that stuff, we're gonna do that on repeat forever. I was like, okay. At this point it's working though. I'm like, okay, like, but I got a couple years, you know, 12, 18 months sober now, and like things are starting to get good. So I'm like, okay, cool. Like, and what's cool was, I remember there was this turning point where I didn't feel like AA was like something I had to do anymore. Like at some point it flipped from like, I was in so much pain and I just needed relief from pain to like, oh, now I'm like moving towards like the upside. Like now I'm starting to go to meetings because like I got some friends there. Like I feel good and I want more of that. Like, and when I get uncomfortable, I start tripping about like money or whatever, job or whatever story I'm telling myself is a problem. It's like, oh, you know what? Like these tools that like these guys taught me, like the get up in the morning and pray, like make a few phone calls, like call your sponsor, help somebody else, like go to a meeting, write a 10th step. I'm like, oh, I got like, I can like deal with this in a way that doesn't land me in like a shitty casino hotel in Commerce, California. Like it takes me like 20 minutes, you know, maybe I go for a run, maybe get some exercise, like try that one. And so step 10 was like, okay, yep, I'm with it. Step 11, prayer, we'd already been doing that. Meditation came online. I went and did a 10-day silent Vipassana meditation retreat as like my boot camp to meditation, because I knew at this point, like, I am not a disciplined person, but if I can't be disciplined, maybe I could be clever. This might have been a little bit of a overdoing it, but I went and did like a 10-day silent Vipassana meditation retreat. It was like one of the most painful, like torturous things I've ever done, because after like 3 days, I remember like going out of my mind. They want you to meditate literally like 8 full hours a day. And I'm sitting there, and like, there's an hour where you can go talk to the teacher in the middle of the day. And I go talk to the teacher, and I'm like, I'm losing it, man. Like, I don't know. I think I'm in over my head. And he goes, "Are you thinking about leaving?" And I was totally thinking about leaving. And out of my mouth comes, "No." And he goes, "Okay, well, then I just suggest that, like, you go back and continue, like, meditating as we instructed." I was like, all right. So I finished the 10 days, and I was like, okay, maybe, like, start with, like, 20 minutes from now on, like, in the morning, something smaller. But it, like, taught me about meditation. And I'll tell you this, like, over that 10 days, the first hour of meditation I did, I sat with myself on a cushion, and my mind, like, every couple seconds, it was like, monkey mind all over the place. And by the end of that 10 days, I could sit and pay attention to my breath for about an hour. And I remember maybe 3 times my mind wandered off and I lost concentration, and I just kind of like gently brought it back. So I realized in that moment that, like, in the same way that I was able to train myself with this routine, not train myself, but you guys helped train me, God, if you will, helped train me, and I, through my actions, the proper use of my own willpower, was able to, like, develop a routine that helped train me into, like, keeping my alcoholism at bay for a short period of time, like a day, I could do the same thing with my mind, with, like, meditation. Like, my mind can actually be trained also. So that taught me a lot about meditation. Anyways, I meditate to this day, like, 20 minutes every morning, and it's, like, a hugely helpful tool for me. And then step 12 was, like, you know, paying it forward, because, like, I could never pay back what I've received in AA. And this gets me to, like, what it's like now, and then I'll wrap it up. You know, I grew up feeling frustrated and angry and scared and not knowing why and not having any solution to, like, dealing with my feelings other than to, like, just get wasted. And I did that for decades. And then it got so bad that I got to come to AA and learn how to address those same problems, not only without the consequences, but with, like, a great deal of upside. So, like, what I've received from AA is that I'm reasonably comfortable most of the time. I'm reasonably comfortable most of the time. When I get uncomfortable, I've got a more accurate assessment of what the problem actually is, which is, like, sitting right between my ears, right? It's not my bank account. It's not you guys. It's not my job. It's not politics. It's not who's in office. It's not what's happening on the news. It's none of that. It is 100% the story that I tell myself about those things, which is entirely in my mind. And once I'm accurate about that problem, you guys have taught me a lot of tools about how to address that, right? It's everything we just talked about in the 12 steps. It's the routine of going to meetings. It's prayer and meditation. It's being plugged into the fellowship. It's helping the next guy the way that my sponsor, Rob V, sat down for years and helped me, right? And somehow by doing all those things, like, we all win. Like, Abram's family was here to celebrate 1 year with him. Like, I was, like, in tears over here watching that. Because I thought for a long time it was just, like, me. I'm only hurting myself. Like, don't worry about it. Like, not only do I got this, but, like, I'm not bothering anybody, so just leave me alone. Turns out I was bothering everybody, right? I was harming my whole family, everyone I knew, indirectly, all the people I work with, like, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, maybe thousands. And in recovery, like, the inverse can be true, right? Like, I feel like I have a debt to pay. I could never pay it back, but, like, maybe I can pay it forward. Maybe I can help the next guy. You know, maybe I can be a little kinder to the next person I interact with on the street. Maybe I can sponsor guys and help them get sober and have this ripple effect for good the way that that was done for me. So I have an obligation to do that. And, you know, it's part of the solution I need. So we all win. We all win when we do this. And my life, like, not only am I, like, mostly free from these things we talked about, this anger, this fear, this shame, this guilt, but, like, even operationally, my life has gotten better. Like, that same woman who was going to kick me out and told me she was giving me an ultimatum if I didn't do a 12-step program, took me out to dinner for my 5-year sobriety date, and we're getting married in 2 months. You know, I haven't drained my bank account in at least 5 years. And you know, so if you're new, I'll just say this, like, I get it. Like, it's hard. It's uncomfortable. I understand, like, it doesn't feel good. But the most important thing that I would love to convey to you, if I can, is this. Like, how you're feeling and how you're doing in early sobriety are not the same thing. Like, it's gonna feel uncomfortable. But it's gonna feel uncomfortable anyway. Like, if you go back out and start drinking and using, like, there's pain there. If you come into the rooms of AA and do this work, that's also gonna be some pain. So you're in for some pain. That's the bad news. But the good news is there's two kinds of pain. There's the pain that leads to more pain, and then there's the pain that leads to liberation. So really the question is, like, which one do you choose? Because this path that we have here, it's uncomfortable, but it leads to freedom. It's not uncomfortable for too long. If it was, we wouldn't do it. Like, we wouldn't all keep doing this if it was just pain the whole time, I promise. So I'm reasonably comfortable most of the time. My life is pretty good. You know, I've got, like, friends here and, like, meetings I go to. My relationships are solid. Things are steady across the board. And I just feel lucky and grateful. I'm lucky to be alive. I'm lucky to be sober. I'm lucky to get the opportunity to come spend this evening talking with you guys and sharing my story. Hopefully that was helpful to at least one of you. And, you know, genuinely from the bottom of my heart, thank you guys for everything that you've done for me. And if there's anything I can do to pay it back or pay it forward, like, let me know. And to the best of my ability, I will do that.
Thank you very much. Jeff, thank you very much. And we hope you come back and visit us soon. Okay. I'd also like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner. And Jeff, if you will lead us out with a prayer of your choice.